Please be sure to visit our Etsy store for some great Warrior Next Door podcast merchandise, and please consider becoming a premium subscriber. Just go to our Facebook page to sign up and receive each series uncut in its entirety.
So they're okay. Let me get this straight. The Bombay doors are open.
Yeah.
These guys are standing straddled over nothing.
Nothing but space.
Nothing but space and wind.
And they may have had on shoes.
And they were instructed, since these bombs had already armed.
One bomb.
They had to lift it up and twist it and drop it out.
Either they had to lift it up a little bit and kick it or something. They had to kick it out of there. But they,
I don't think I'd want to kick an armed bomb.
Well, you wouldn't kick it that hard.
Oh, Warrior Next Door listeners, did you hear that? That did not sound OSHA compliant to me at all. That sounded like something that could only happen when there's a huge Titanic struggle like World War II, and that's exactly where that happened. In fact, who you just heard from right there is George Bernard Menkoff. He was in the 8th Army, United States Army Air Force during the Great Crusade in World War II, where our 8th Army bombers were able to come in and help lay waste to the Nazi war machine. He was part of the ordnance section of the 550 Bomb Group, 385th Bomb Group, Station 155 in Great Ashfield, Suffolk, England. And we've got this and a few more surprises with George as we go forward, but we'll launch into that later. So welcome to Warrior Next Door. I'm Tony Lupo.
I'm Ryan Fairfield.
And welcome to our journey. This is the Warrior Next Door podcast, where we share oral histories from veterans whose stories provide an intimate look at world history and how much it still affects us today. All the veterans featured were interviewed by your co-hosts while serving as volunteers for the Library of Congress. Our interviews, over 200 in total, were conducted with veterans who live in our cities, our neighborhoods, and often right next door to us. You can listen to the full-length, unedited interviews from each veteran we feature on our YouTube and Facebook pages. Come join us. All right. So welcome to another episode of The Warrior Next Door. And as we mentioned, or you heard in the intro clip, you know, George Menkoff had some front row seat to some pretty sketchy stuff that occurred during the war, which is always going to occur when you're dealing with large bombers full of exploding ordnance. And of course, he worked in the ordnance section. So, Ryan, you conducted the interview with George. Do you remember how you connected with him and when this interview took place?
Yes. So, for anyone who's been listening to our podcast for a while, you may remember the Gerald Gentis series. He flew on B-17s. He was stationed out of Great Ashfield, England. Well, Jerry lived just a few miles away from where I lived at the time, here in Bixby, Oklahoma. And after I got to know Jerry, he's like, "Hey, you know, there's a guy that lives here in town. He was in the ordnance group, you know, at my base, you know, and everything." So he says, "You really ought to reach out to him and you know, and interview him." So that's how I got a hold of George Menkoff.
Which for our audience, that's how we end up interviewing most of our interviews, our individuals, is we interview somebody and through word of mouth, we end up connecting other people, which is another example of that.
That's right. So I reached out to George. I think we ended up scheduling this interview, and we did it on November the 12th, almost exactly 16 years ago.
And today would be?
November the 11th. It's Veterans Day.
Yeah, it's our Veterans Day special.
So there's some poignant value here in all this. But yeah, it's amazing that the interview took place nearly 16 years ago to the day.
16 years ago?
Yeah.
I can't believe that.
I know. It doesn't seem that long ago at all.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Holy cow.
So I went and interviewed George. Great guy. Got to meet him. Got to meet his wife. Very soft-spoken guy. And we had a great conversation. So fast forward to 2023, and I am out at the Tulsa Air and Space Museum, And because the B-29 dock is in town, and I've never seen a B-29 up close. I've never been able to walk through one before, and you could do that with this. So that's what I did. I went out there with a friend of mine and his boys, and we're standing in this long line to go tour the B-7 or the B-29. And talking with my friend Todd, you know, we're talking about all sorts of stuff, World War II. There's all these other people standing around in bomber T-shirts and stuff. Everybody, you know, are all fans of World War II history. And there's a gentleman standing in front of me, and he starts kind of, you know, chatting with us a bit whenever we're there talking about everything. And he starts talking about how his dad was in World War II and loaded B-17 bombers over in England. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. I'm thinking to myself, I think I interviewed a guy that did that once, you know, and we start talking some more, and come to find out this guy is George Minkoff's son.
Dude, we should have him on our podcast.
Well,
I mean, think about the odds of that. Where you're standing in line in a B-29 and you guys are talking history and you're telling me that there's this guy standing next to you.
I should have bought a lottery ticket.
You should have. And this person was the son of George Minkoff, the person we're featuring today. Oh, that's crazy.
That's crazy.
So how did this, what happened?
Well, so as luck would have it, I said, you know, I'm talking to this fella, his name's David Minkoff, and I said, hey, well, who is your dad? You know, oh, his name is George Minkoff. I'm like, I interviewed your dad. And then David's like, really? You were the guy that interviewed him?
So
I was like, yeah. I was like, yeah, that was me.
So he remembered that he was interviewed and that you interviewed him.
Yeah, because I'd given him copies of the DVD of the video and stuff. And so that's what we always do when we interview the veterans. We'll provide a free copy. Now DVD video is kind of falling out of, you know, the technology favor, I guess, and stuff. But that was what we always gave them. And then they could give copies to their children, grandchildren, and so on. So as I spoke to David, I'm like, you know what? We're going to do a series on your dad at some point. Love to have you come participate in the series. And la-di-da, we have David Minkoff here with us today.
Ooh,
yeah.
And so what we're going to do is, well, first of all, David, welcome to the Green Barn, as we kind of call this place. This is where we make all of our crazy, stupid comments all the time, and we record them and blast it around the world.
And people actually listen to it. Can you believe that?
A lot of times they make fun of us, but, you know, so. But anyway, we're really happy to have you here. And, you know, what are your, you know, just quickly, you know, whenever I ran into you that day, what didn't you think? I'm like, what are the odds? We're standing right there in line together.
Exactly. It was like, holy cow.
Yeah, I know. You know, and we talk, Tony and I talk all the time about, you know, I kind of call them God winks, or these like kind of little divine things that seem to, these divine coincidences that happen. And we've had a number, you know, Tony and I think someday we're going to do an entire show on all these weird spine tingling coincidences that have happened to us that are just purely outlandishly crazy. But this is one that I chalk up to it, for me to be standing in line right next to you in this very long line of people, and we start talking, and you're the son of George.
Were you aware that your father had been interviewed by someone for the Veterans History Project?
Oh, yes.
You were. So how did you first learn that your father was interviewed? Did you have a chance to listen to the interview at some point?
You know, I may have been actually at the house when they did it.
Oh, really? When
I may have
was
been.
There.
I may have been, yeah.
Which is even more incredible. And so that's one of the things that Ryan and I talk about. We go to people's houses, we conduct these interviews, we provide a DVD for the family in case the veteran wants to share it with other people, or their family wants to make it part of their, you know, their heritage, their ancestry. And then, of course, we also send a copy of it to the Library of Congress, which is where a copy of this is. But we always wonder, you know, does anyone know that this happened in the family? Did they ever listen to these things? And so you knew, you were aware that this was happening already.
Definitely, yeah. And I know everybody in the family has a copy of the CD.
Oh, that's great.
I know they do, yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Well, that's the sort of thing that really completes the journey for Tony and I think, whenever we do these interviews and we give all these, you know, a stack of copies of 5 discs or whatever to the veteran, we hope that they get distributed to the kids and grandkids and not just sit in a box in a closet somewhere. You know, so that's great.
Yeah,
I like to hear that.
So that really amplifies, you know, having you here today. Not only did you guys run into each other serendipitously waiting to view this amazing aircraft, but just through the course of casual conversation, you know, you had to know that your father got interviewed. You had to understand what Ryan was saying about the whole thing. I mean, if you didn't know that he had interviewed, if you had never listened to DV, if none of that happened, then that connection wouldn't have occurred. So your interest in your father's, in your father, period, is a big reason why you're here today, because you knew enough about your father and what he was doing to make the link that, oh, Ryan mm-hmm. was the guy that interviewed my dad, and mm-hmm. you're the son, and that's so awesome. Anyway, we're so happy to have you here today.
Yeah. Well, thanks.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah. Well, do you have any other things you want to add real quick before we jump in and we start listening to your dad tell his story? Everything?
I think we're okay. Let's
okay. It's really great. It's really great to have you. You made the long drive out here to the middle of nowhere to join us here and stuff. And
So I just have a few more questions before
we get
started.
Go ahead, Tony. Yeah.
So when you rolled in and met George, describe George. Tell us a little bit about him and what you remember when you did the interview.
Well, this was 16 years ago. And these guys have far better memories than I do of things. But, you know, in watching the video, I'm like, oh, that's right. That's what George – I remember what George looks like now and stuff. You know,
he was at the time – I mean, now, didn't he own a gymnasium?
Well, I did.
You owned the fitness center.
I owned the gym, but he was there a lot, yes.
Okay, because I think while I was there interviewing him, there was like an alarm that went off at the gym, and he had to leave and go down there, or maybe you guys did, and I stayed there with your mom while wait for you guys to come back and everything, because there was some, I don't know if the alarm, the security system went off or something like
probably
that.
Probably so. I remember that, yeah.
So that makes sense. So Dave's sitting here right now. If I had to describe Dave, he looks like a bulldog. He's got a big, thick neck and big arms and tattoos on there.
Yeah.
So just so everyone know, Dave looks like someone who owns a gym and uses it once in a while.
George was, I remember him being kind of probably around, 5'8", 5'7", something like that. Pretty thin guy. And his name was Dr. George Minkoff.
Oh, okay.
And now he was a dentist, is that correct?
Correct.
So we'll get into a little bit of discussion of that, because I think he mentions a bit of that in his story.
Yeah.
How he had his prerequisites for dentistry done at certain times before he got in. So that's kind of my recollection of George. And
All right.
I remember your mom was just awesome. She was a super sweet person. And
well, I will add something on that. Everybody said, your mom was so sweet. I said, yes, but you never crossed her.
Well, that's the way most of the mama bears are, right?
Oh, yeah. I don't mean it like that.
Okay.
So let's go ahead and kick it. And like Dave said, let's go ahead and hear from his father.
Okay, we're here today on November the 12th, 2007, with Dr. George Minkoff. He was in the Ordnance Section of the 550th Bomb Squadron, 385th Bomb Group, 8th Air Force. He was stationed at Great Ashfield, Suffolk, England, Station 155. He was in the ground crew for heavy bombers, and those being B-17s. What I always like to do is just start out and ask you, where were you when you heard about Pearl Harbor?
Well, that was a long time ago, but 1941. So I was working, we were out in California, mm-hmm. and I got a summons from the Army that even though I was in, I guess you call it crucial defense work, but it they took me anyway. And by that time, we bought a house out there in California, making $52 a week, I think it was, and had a lot of money in those days. And so they wanted me back to go back to Tulsa and be inducted in the Army. So I didn't go to try to talk them into doing it here in Los Angeles. I just said, let's go home, Rick. So we sold a house, and take no time at all to sell that house. Didn't take long, and I was in the Army and down Fort Sill and going, and they checked and see I'd had a couple of years, 2.5 years of college. I already had my pre-dentistry done at that time. And then went on down to Fort Sill, and of course they go through processing down there, and that's when they decide if where you ought to go, Army, Navy, Air Force. Well, you won't be in the Army. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad they decided Air Force. Because, you know, that was awful bad, that the Army part of it, mm-hmm. doing the landing at D-Day and all of that. It was just terrible. And, of course, it's dangerous in the Army and the Air Force, too.
Yeah, so amen to that. It was as dangerous all over the place back then. So,
well, did I for the audience, this happens a lot where for a lot of time when Ryan and I were collecting these interviews, we couldn't do it together. There's too many people to interview, mm-hmm. so we divided and conquered. So, in full disclosure, this is one of those interviews where I'm hearing it for the first time right now as we're recording it. Did I hear him right? Was he from Oklahoma originally?
Yes.
And then he was out in Los Angeles working.
Yes.
Making a lot of money for 1940-41. And then he was in pre-dentistry and married.
Yeah, and he actually went out there to study photography.
He mentioned, initially, yeah.
Yeah.
And then he said, I know more than
That's right.
than instructors did actually.
Yeah, he had taken classes at TU, at University of Tulsa, here, and then he decided he wanted to go out to California and take photography classes, got out there, was like, I know more than these guys do. Then he started taking pre-dentistry classes.
Well, he'd already had that, actually.
Oh, he already had it.
He already had done his 2.5. Before they moved to California, he was done with his pre-dental program.
But that makes all this even that much more intriguing to me. So the typical path we hear for people who are drafted into the war is they're a lot younger. Mm-hmm. They're usually, a lot of times, they're out of work or finally got jobs out of the Great Depression. But your father was established. He was a married man making good money out in Los Angeles, California. He got pulled in, right?
Yeah, he worked at... He mentioned working for the defense something or other.
Where I thought he said North American, like where they...
Well, it wasn't Douglas. Mom worked at Douglas in Tulsa. One of the other ones, I can't think of what the name of it was. But yeah, he was a machinist.
Mm-hmm. So it seems really, this is not typical path for most of the draftees, where you've got someone who's older, married, established, already skilled in a couple of things. And then you draft them. Mm-hmm. And then your dad decides, if this is correct, and of course we've got his son right here next to me, which is great. He decides, all right, fine, this is going to happen. Let's pull up stakes, sell our house, and go back home, basically. And then off to the war he's going to go eventually. Is that correct?
Right, yeah. He actually worked at North American Rockwell.
Ah,
yeah, that's gotcha. Where he worked.
Yep, a major defense contractor in World War II that produced the Mustang, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so... Okay, sorry, I just wanted to kind of
unpack
that.
I mean, he's obviously a multi-capable guy. I mean, he's a machinist. He's got his pre-dentistry. He's got an eye to the future here.
Yeah, he's older. He's married.
He's into photography. I mean, he's a renaissance man in a lot of ways. You know,
so not your typical story that we hear when we interview, and we've done over 200 of these interviews of the type of person ends up getting drafted. But yeah, go ahead and continue, Ryan. I just was kind of like, whoa, this is not normal.
But I went from there to Miami Beach, and I didn't want any families down there. Mm-hmm. And you went through all that marching and shooting the gun, the rifle, and target practice, and marching and marching and marching, and you had to be in good shape. And whether there was any, I don't think I can remember of any actual schools we had down there. And one good thing about it, we were stationed in Miami Beach, and lived in little apartments around there, around the Miami Beach, and ate at the McFadden Deauville. All of our dinners were at McFadden Deauville. That's sort of a swanky at that time, I guess. It was a swanky hotel down in Miami Beach. Went from there, well, by Christmas Day, they had it all planned, what you're going to have for Christmas and everything, so it looked good. And but I think it was Christmas morning, we were called out to the station to get on the train to go someplace. We didn't know where. Mm-hmm. I didn't. And so that was, that threw that Christmas dinner that we're going to get out of the window. We didn't get that. And cranberry sauce and turkey and all of that. And of course, it was on a troop train. And they had to do all that waiting, you know, I guess waiting out there for a couple of hours before they finally put you on the train. So if I remember, there wasn't any place to sleep on it, and we just sat in upright chairs, and some would be playing cards, and we'd wave at people through the windows when we go to the small, through the train, went through small towns, and ended up in, and it was called the Oldsmobile School of Armament. Take every one of those guns apart in detail, blindfolded, and put back together blindfolded.
Wow.
And I guess you call it field stripping. And but you do it blindfolded because you never know, you have to do it in the night sometime, you know. And the one, I don't like to brag, but if you made 100 in every, on every gun, on every part, every gun, I guess we might have had more than one test, but I know we had one on every gun. If you made 100 in all of them, you got your name up on a, be inscribed or something, but on a placard or something, and all the men it was in went through there that made 100% on every test, and I was one of them that did that.
Wow.
I don't want that to be bragging.
That's okay.
Later on, they had a whole, several squadrons out there, and they were after we went to war, and they had a 20-millimeter cannon out there. They couldn't get it to feed, and they had a guy working on it. He was also a pessimist, but I guess he didn't make 100 in all of them, all the tests of it. They asked me to come over there, and I said, well, the feed lever's upside down. So I saved the day that day. But anyway.
So I just want to jump in here. They obviously peg George for having a great mechanical mind. You know, they've got him in weapons specialist mode here. All of his training prior to this, you obviously start off with basic training, got to get him into shape. Teach him how to march, army discipline, all that kind of stuff. Then he gets sent to Michigan.
Yeah,
that's where
the Oldsmobile plant,
where he learns, about basic ordnance, things like that. And then he'll start moving now into learning more about the infantry sidearms, you know, M1 Garand and things like that.
So I thought it was funny. He was like, I'm not bragging, you know, but I got 100%. No, George, you're not bragging. You're just explaining. And in fact, later on, he goes to that 20-millimeter cannon. He goes, I guess that guy didn't get 100% on a test because the feed mechanism was upside down. It was awesome. Oh. Did your dad have a sense of humor like that?
Yeah, yeah. He did.
Is that
he
pretty?
Did.
And let me. So you know, we're a couple clips into this now, Dave. Is it kind of weird hearing your father in his voice with these recollections after all these years of him, you know, have been passed away?
Yeah, it is in a way. Yeah, it's sometimes on this I've noticed on the videos that he's trying to work pretty hard, trying to remember.
Yeah, sure.
Kind of stumbling around with these words a little bit, but I mean, it's been a long time ago, obviously.
Oh my gosh! Well,
you know,
I mean, and the other thing that's interesting, and you know, we call ourselves the kind of the punk rock history podcast. Everything that's done is done by Ryan and I. We don't have people. We don't hire anything out. And we rolled into these people's houses who trusted, in this case, Ryan enough to sit in there and hear some, you know, pretty amazing things. In the background, you can hear the tick-tock of the clock.
You can hear your mom talking
on the
phone.
Mom talking. Was it kind of weird hearing these sounds again from that house?
No. I've actually, that clock actually that's ticking in the background is above my fireplace.
Oh,
right,
that's
now.
Fantastic.
Awesome.
That's fantastic. there's a part in here later. I took it out. Because it was distracting, but the phone was ringing and stuff, and your mom, you could hear your mom go hello, but the phone kept ringing, hello, and the phone kept ringing. It's like she was picking up the wireless phone and she wasn't hitting the answer button.
Right, right.
That's so funny.
We pick up these little bloopers all the time on tape, and a lot of times we'll leave them in. Sometimes we don't because. you know, this isn't one of these Steven Spielberg productions where everything is like hyper produced and beautifully focused and all that. This is just a couple of dudes going out there and getting to know the people in our own neighborhoods that did some amazing stuff. So sorry, Ryan, go ahead and keep kicking it.
All right. No worries. So he's in Michigan at this point, and now he's going to talk about some of the training he got, like I mentioned, on some of the infantry sidearms that, you know, M1 Garand and the carbine and the like.
And then it went from there, because getting to Salt Lake City, Utah, and I don't know what the name of the base was anymore. And this tough sergeant was out there, and he said, "You're here, you know, we got to work. We had to go to school up there, and somebody else worked for us." He said, "You're here for a week's work, and by golly, you're going to work." Did you ever see a meatloaf pan that had those meatloaves that did about, looked like it about burned in there, cleaning those pans out? That I've never had anything so hard to clean in my life. But anyway, we worked that week. And the first sergeant was correct. It was tough. Went from there to Fort George Wright, Washington, at the Spokane. Well, she got to go there, too.
Now, what were you being trained for at all these bases?
I've been trained for this weapons specialist, knowing all the guns. And these were guns. They were, you know, the three big guns in Oldsmobile School of Armament. And then here was going to be the side weapons, and carbines, and Garand rifle, and all. And so we studied, like I told you a while ago, the other 45 was in that, and all the sidearms and Garand rifle. And from that, we went to Geiger Field. That was also a Spokane. And then we started putting everything, because the other members of the crews and all, or armament, you had ordnance men like I was, and you had armament section also. And they're the ones that took care of the guns that we supplied for them. And we could repair them, but they did their own our armament man did their own repairing. And then we learned how to put all the things together to make a mission. Mm-hmm. But we were only one squadron that started up there with the 550th Squadron. And then we just trained, like I said, to get the crews to work harmonizingly and taking the and going on a mission. But then when we get our same squadron, we left there and went to Cutbank, Montana. And I didn't know where it was going. And we got on the train and went to Cutbank, and that's when we started making missions. So we went to Cutbank, but when the train pulled in, we got off with the wives were already there. And so how they got there and how they knew where they were going, I thought troop movements were a secret. But the wives were there already waving at us when we got off the plane, off the train. So we went on to Cutbank Army Air Base.
Women know everything.
Cutbank Army Air Base. And that's when I said we started learning how to actually get up there and load practice bombs on, and they'd take them out, and the bombardier would practice on those practice bombs hitting the target. And we would, of course, do our bomb loading and everything like we would be doing when we got over to England. We didn't know we were going to England. I'd been going Pacific at that time, but I don't know. But we ended up going to England. And so that went on for a month or so. And while we was, 4 or 5 weeks of training, and I don't think any more than that. And then we were ready to go to Camp Jersey.
All right, so I just want to jump in here. So he's finished all of his training stateside And now they're moving back across country. They're making their way to the East Coast.
Yeah.
He didn't know where they were going to go for sure. You know, and we, Tony and I have talked about this before. I always assumed that once you got on that train and you started going east or you started going west, you kind of had an idea of what theater you're probably going to go to. But he's getting sent all over the place. He's down in Miami Beach, and he ends up all the way up in Spokane, Washington. He goes from Miami Beach to Michigan, yeah, to Salt Lake City, to all the way up to Geiger Field up in Washington. And it still amazes me the amount of time and investment and money that they put into these guys, which they needed to have, obviously, mm-hmm, for training back then. You know, I mean, he said, he'll say here in a second, that he went over in summer of 42, which was really about, you know, I don't know if he got in, if he got into the military pre-December 7 or post-December 7. I think it was post.
I'm not sure.
So if it was post-December 7.
And it probably was.
Then it was only 6 months of it was 6 months of training, and he was on his way over.
Yeah, and we've said this before, excuse me, Dave, is that a lot of these veterans grew up during the Great Depression, and travel wasn't something that is as common as it is now. And a lot of these veterans remember very vividly their training because a lot of times it was the first time they saw all these places. Now, your father, when he was drafted, had already traveled from Oklahoma to California, so he's done a bit of travel. But when you were growing up, did he talk about this period? Did he refer back to some of these places that he went to at all?
Well, if we had to talking about it, yes. But if it wasn't brought up, not really.
Gotcha. And that's pretty common, too, with a lot of these veterans. But the thing that Ryan and I marvel at is when we interview somebody, it doesn't matter how old they are or how far removed they are from their time in the service, they seem to recall very vividly all the different places that they hopped around to, probably because they were young. It was new. It was exciting. That's our working hypothesis right now. You know, it's significantly different than what they were doing prior to the war, and they got inducted. So 6 months, and now they're going to send them overseas, huh?
That's right, yeah.
And I want to add one more thing. My father was a weapons specialist during the Vietnam War for the U.S. Navy.
Oh, that's
and
correct.
So a lot of the things that your father talked about doing, rebuilding, repairing, understanding a wide variety of different weapons, everything from Colt 45, 45 ACP pistols all the way up to big bombs and stuff and guns. My father was doing the same thing in Vietnam. It sounded really interesting to hear him talk about it.
One time he and I were at some sporting goods store somewhere, and so we were looking at some of the guns, and Dad goes, "Let me see that 45. So he brings it out, and Dad, boom, 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 boom. He has it totally, totally taken apart.
The guy behind the counter is like, "Oh, what just happened
he
here?
He just broke it."
Because he probably, the guy behind the counter probably didn't know how to put it back together.
And I remember Dad goes, "There was some small piece in the mechanism somewhere." He said, "I bet you didn't even know this was here, did you?" He goes, "No." Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
That's awesome.
So, you know, I hear him, okay, this is just a little thing, but he mentioned the M1 Garand.
Yeah.
Is it Garand?
It's or, Garand, but...
But I think he would know how it's pronounced.
Well, so here's the thing, though. It's now today called the Garand. And actually, the person who made it, the person's name, he actually pronounced his name Garand. And we twisted that to Garand. But when your father, when George was working on these, this weapon system was probably 3 or 4 years old. It was brand new. It was the first mass-produced, fully semi-automatic, you know, one pull of the trigger, one round comes out, standard-issue infantry rifle in the world. The Russians had some, but they were in limited quantity, and they were phased out because they were too complex, and they broke a lot. The Germans would end up copying some of our models and their models to make one later in the war. So where I'm going with this is this would have been a new thing. There would have been people calling it Garand, Durands. There have been all of these things because it's just a new weapon system. And if you're 22, 23 years old and your instructor comes in and they call it a gerund because it's a new weapon system, that's what's going to stick with you. Sure. That's what you're going
to
call it.
That's why I figured, you know, those obviously he had the training on all of it, and that's how he pronounced it. So I wonder if that's the way it was pronounced. But
yeah, I'm sure it was pronounced several different ways at that time. And whatever you were exposed to first, it would have stuck. We've got the benefit in hindsight of history where we know all the research and development, the Grand, and people who enjoy shooting these military rifles can know that they call it Garand and Garand, but Grand is what stuck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, all right. So now we're going to move into the part. This is where George gets on the Queen Elizabeth and makes his way across the ocean, and a couple of the stories that he has to tell about that trip.
Well, that was our port of embarkation. That's when we're going out.
Did you take a ship over the ocean, or did you fly over?
Queen Elizabeth. Going across there, and of course we zigzagged all the time because they were sinking our merchant ships left and right with their submarines.
When did you actually? What year was it? Was it 1942 then that you went to go overseas?
Yeah.
Was it fall? What, you know? Do you
remember? It was summer.
It was summer of 42?
Yeah. Oh. We got, but I lived so far, I didn't get, we got 3 or 4 days off before we took off from there. Now, Marie didn't come there. She went back to Oklahoma and stayed with my folks. And I don't know, a couple of weeks is about all we were there at the port of embarkation. And then we got on our, like I said, on Queen Elizabeth and made the journey across. I thought I'd see a lot of games going on, and I saw that poker game going on. So, well, I'm going to get in that. And there was a big circle, bigger this table or bigger, the people. And I think we went bust. The guy went in with me and covered blackjack. Did I say poker? It was blackjack. And we went busted, I think, the first three times, and that was it. I don't know. It could have turned out the other way. We could have really started hitting right off the bat, but couldn't get 21. And then we landed in Wales, I think it was, someplace over there, and made our trip to Elmswell, Suffolk, England. And that's where the 385th Bomb Group was. It was called, each one of them had a name, it was called Great Ashfield. And when we first got there, it wasn't completed yet. Barracks that we lived in were not completed. So we were in tents, and it's sort of dampish in there. And you take I don't even know whether, I guess we took off our clothes. And I can't remember having pajamas or anything. But but we get up the next morning to put them on, they'd be damp, you know. Humidity, England covered with water around it, you know. And just sort of be damp and cold. And of course, then when he finally got the barracks built, it had a little coke stove at one end and a little coke stove at the other end. That's all we had it for. And we didn't have much coke. That was rationed. Because so many of those all over England, I don't see how a small nation was able to supply it all. Mm.
Yeah, especially in 42.
And it didn't actually get you that that warm either, and it was a real cold night. And so they had a big sort of canvas cover, three sections of a mattress, about that, 4 inches thick, would make long enough for a bed. You slide it in this cover, and sometimes it was cold. We'd take the bags out, the mattress bag pads, or more like pads, out, and we would slip into the mattress mattress cover, and I'd even put my coat on top of me, and I think some of the others did too.
Huh. How cold did it get?
Oh, I don't know what temperature it was in there, but it was uncomfortable. Mm. Well, the Coke would finally burn out. Mm-hmm. And the little Coke stove had a chimney going out, a little round metal chimney going out through the top. So we started out exercising in the mornings and getting ourselves in conditioning, in good condition. And while we were doing that with the crews, of course they all came in too, same time the ground crew came in, or shortly after. And then they started making their bomb runs and everything, and we'd load them up with practice bombs and that would go. That went on probably for a month.
So he's in England. He's arrived.
He's freezing his butt off.
He's freezing his butt off. And I don't know if you recall, I mean, whenever Jerry Gentis was talking about this very same airfield in the barracks, he talked about the three-section mattress.
Yeah, about those crappy British three-section mattresses that always slid apart and your butt was always in a crack or a leg was in a crack. I like George's solution to it. I'm not even going to use it that way. I'm going to open them up and use it as a big sleeping bag.
A big sleeping bag, right.
Like, screw it. These are stupid.
And, you know, I remember, didn't Jerry say that it would freeze on the inside of the tent?
Yeah.
Yeah.
England's known for not really having particularly harsh winters in terms of like really deep cold snaps or snows or all that. But with that warm Gulf current coming up in that area that helps moderate the temperature in the wintertime, comes this type of cold that people...
It's piercing.
They don't understand.
It's a high humidity cold.
I didn't experience it until I moved to Houston. Mm. And Houston's really humid. It's right near the Gulf Coast, obviously. And we would get some of those cold, you know, winter days. And I grew up in Michigan. You grew up in Illinois. We know a little bit about the cold, right?
Yeah, right.
And there's a whole bunch of ways to get cold, and this is one of them. And the other thing that, you know, I'd like to remind the audience is a lot of the 8th Army Air Force people that we've interviewed that talk about going over there, they came over in 1944. That was the big push. I mean, George is there really early. He's there in the early days when we were still mustering our forces, when our B-17s were getting clobbered.
And when the German wolf packs were really wreaking havoc in the Atlantic.
In 1942, going across into Queen Elizabeth was a benefit because it was so fast it could outrun the U-boats, but they still had to zigzag. And remember, one of the previous episodes, we featured Captain John Graham.
Right.
And we went into great detail about the perils of not just going across the Atlantic Ocean in 1942, but just mustering off the East Coast, the number of ships that just were... sunk within sight of our population centers, our legion. Mm-hmm. You know, German U-boats coming to the surface, surfacing. Yeah. Thank you. Near pleasure yachts and yelling at the people in the pleasure yachts, saying, "Don't you know there's a war going on? Get the hell out of here!" I mean, those things happened. So yeah, he came into the war when just getting to the front line was perilous. Mm-hmm. And then the accommodations were sparse. The Americans weren't able to bring in all this equipment yet. And, you know, at this point in 42, England had been to war for 3 years and they were deeply impoverished. Everything was rationed. And so, yeah, it sounds like early days in World War II when things weren't necessarily going too well for the Allies at this point.
Right. And you know, one of the things he talks about the cold, and they used coke-fueled stoves. And I'd always heard the term coke, you know, for heating, and finally looked it up to try to figure out, okay, I want to know more about what the process is for making coke. And it's a coal derivative. I mean, they actually bake it at high heat to bake out the impurities. And then it's what's left is a very efficient heat source.
A very high BTU. They used it for smelting iron ore and steel.
Yeah.
They would coke the furnaces to melt iron.
So if he was saying that it didn't warm you up very much, they probably gave them like a D-cell size battery of coke.
Here's a
to
couple
burn.
Of hockey puck pieces of coke. There you go. Sleep tight, guys. See you tomorrow.
Yeah. So anyway, I just thought that was interesting. I love hearing about the things they did. You know, a lot of these guys, they talk about these drip gasoline stoves that they have. They'd have gasoline that would be, they said, oh, I've heard guys talk about this. You know, oh, we rigged up a drip stove. You know, like, what?
Yeah.
And it's, they'd use gasoline to rig it up to where it would just drop a drop of gasoline and woof, right. You know, woof, yeah. You know, and it's like, this is crazy.
If you had that going on in the 1940s, and here we are in 2023, and there's people upset that we're using natural gas to heat our homes, you know what I'm saying? Because, or they want to ban natural gas stoves because they're pollutants, right? It's like, come on, man, give me a break.
Yeah.
This concludes episode one of the three-part George Minkoff series on the Warrior Next Door podcast. Please join us for the next episode where George talks about his daily routine loading the ordnance on the B-17s in his bomb squadron.